The natural world is a source of inspiration for all kinds of businesses. And in this time when many of us are thinking about quality, craftsmanship, and the impact of our purchases, this week we're focusing on how nature can very often drive businesses and help them grow. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. On today's episode, conversations with two incredible women from two very different industries and backgrounds, but whose passion for work and creating is rooted in nature and the places they grew up. Coming up on the show, we'll meet Sylvie Shantakai, a pioneer in the beauty industry whose career is defined by what her eponymous label has given back. She created beauty brands for Dian Van Furstenberg and for Estée Lauder before setting out on her own to create a family business all about natural ingredients and creating products that raise awareness about the conservation projects which have become her life's work. But first, whiskey. Dr. Rachel Berry is known as the First Lady of Scotch. From the northeast of Scotland, Rachel grew up amongst some incredible landscapes near the heart of whiskey production in Speyside. She studied chemistry at the University of Edinburgh and afterwards took a job as a research assistant at the Scotch Whisky Research Institute, where she fell in love with the science and stories behind distilleries which are known right around the world. Rachel has worked and consulted for Glenmorangie, Bowmore, Auchentoshan, and a host of other distilleries, but is now the master blender for Benriach, a distillery in Speyside. This autumn, after years of work, the distillery re-released its range of single malts with a flavor profile created by Rachel as a celebration of Benriach's heritage and unique natural surroundings. The range comes in sharp, reimagined packaging, and more than 120 years after opening, the distillery will now also feature a visitor center for the first time. Here's my conversation with Rachel Berry about breathing new life into Benriach.
So the heritage of the distillery goes back to 1898, and sadly it was closed. It had a checkered history, and it was closed for 65 years between 1900 and 1965 after the Paterson crash, which was basically like the Wall Street crash of the whiskey industry at the time. But the floor maltings continued to produce. This is where the barley from the field is dried, and Benriach has its own floor maltings, and it continued throughout that time, and that's really what kept it alive, and it supplied malt to other distilleries. But come 1965, 1966 was when the distillery began distilling again, and it's been distilling ever since then. And the oldest whiskey we have goes right back to 1966. It's quite remarkable. And we also have the richest profile of smoky whiskies, I think, definitely in Speyside and possibly in Scotland, right back to the 1970s. So we have these different styles that mean that you can create flavour within one distillery, which is really quite rare, especially going back to the 1970s.
You know, you have the title of Master Blender, which is incredible, an artisan in the craft of creating and aging whiskies, creating these incredible flavour profiles. For people that will know whiskey will perhaps know a little bit of the difference between things that they like or different regions, what a Speyside whiskey is like. Can you talk to us a little bit about how you sort of bring out the heritage of the brand, but also sort of reflect the place? You'll have a different range, as you've talked about there, some smokier stuff, but talk to us a little bit more in depth about the range.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, it all starts with the spirit of the still, and Benriach gets his name, actually, Benriach, from Ben Little Hill. It's on a little hill, and it's on the site of the old Riach farm. There are quite a few Riachs in Scotland, and what this means is variety or diversity. And it's quite incredible that John Duff, when he founded the distillery in 1898, named it that, because the distillery became this beautiful, diverse distillery with all its styles. It's really quite incredible. But for me, it's about understanding the spirit of the still and every element to it. So from the barley right through to the bottle. And with Benriach, you know, to capture that sense of place, we've got the mineral-rich water from aquifer deep down beneath the distillery. It's very clear, very pure. We have a signature four-water mash. We control the temperatures to gently open up the malt and give a really signature smoothness from the malt. And we have pear-shaped stills and a very long spirit cut in the middle, which means that we almost have a rainbow flavour of fruit, right from apples and pears through to creamy malt, right through to a little bit of spice in the end. But it always has this luscious fruit forward character. And then I get to play, decide on the wood types, with everything from bourbon to rum cask to Marsala to Madeira, port. And through experimenting and trial and error, really, I kind of work to create the flavour of Speyside. So, for example, in the original 10, the original 10 to me is just like summer in a glass. It has the sweetness of the malt, it has the luscious orchard fruit and some toasted oak spice, but just a little. And it just is like going out into Speyside on a summer's day, seeing the blue sky and all those wonderful smells and tastes, that freshness and the sweetness of the malt and the fruit. And then the smoky ones, well, is like being at the end of summer or, you know, into winter in a, you know, a smoky barbecue in the middle of the pine woodlands beside the Spey. That was the imagination of the taste. And as a child, I obviously was in Speyside and experienced that. So these smells are inherent in the location. And when you taste them, you go straight to Speyside. The beautiful fruit and this lovely aromatic, sweet, smoky barbecue smell. But equally, you could be anywhere in the world. It's very gourmand. So if you enjoy sweet and smoky food, I think you're going to love the smoky 10 or the smoky 12. So yeah, it's bringing to life all these flavors. And in each of the bottles, there are three different types of casks. So between the 10, the smoky 10, the 12, and the smoky 12. Each one of these is three casks matured. And what this does is it brings out the perfect balance of fruit, malt, and oak in each individual bottle. And this gives a world of flavor for the consumer to explore and discover.
Well, I have a bottle of the 10 here, and it is the middle of the day, but I can say I'm about ready for a dram after that, those descriptions now. You know, you talked about sort of the rebirth of the distillery after being shuttered for many years, and that's not, in many senses, a unique story for a Scottish distillery. That's happened many, many times over, and it almost seems to me like it's a new age of distilling now where there's such huge interest around the world, I think, and there's so much opportunity there. And perhaps even more so in the fact that there is this sort of craft boom that's been happening where there's distilleries in all different regions around the world. Some of them sort of copy the single malt style. Others are completely different, but that sort of allows Scotland to do what it does best. Do you feel that? Do you feel like we're going into a really good period for distilleries?
Absolutely. Gosh, I mean, I've been in the industry for nearly 30 years and, you know, the industry has its ups and downs, but at the end of the day, in the long run, it's always going up. And I think more so than ever before, you know, people are moving into single malt, especially for the first time, or they're exploring flavour in different parts of Scotland. They're starting to understand more about malt. I think especially at the moment, it's connecting people. There's so many tastings and get-togethers and people connecting to talk about single malt because it's such a rich, rich, rich story and people just grow to love it. So I think there's definitely a trend. You know, it's almost like, I suppose, the growth in wine in the 1980s and how people started to get to know the different grape varieties, the different regions. And now is the turn of single malt to invite people in to explore. On each of our bottles, we actually have the story of the whisky, and it tells you that it's richly peated, or it's got a trace of smoke, or it's three casks matured, and what those casks are. And, you know, it really invites the consumer in to discover and explore. And I think it's with such a richness of story, obviously that is a big part of the journey, as well, of course, as the delicious taste.
You know, I'm just curious about you personally, Rachel. Before starting with Ben Rieck, you have worked directly for or consulted for a number of distilleries people will have heard of in Scotland, in different regions as well. I'm curious about not only growing up and where you thought you would work, but for a young person now, perhaps from Speyside or anywhere in Scotland, really, what the prospects are to work in the industry with this huge interest around the world, renewed interest, let's say, in single malt whiskey. I know there are some university programs directly about distilling, but what might the future be like for someone thinking about getting into the industry? And for you, many years ago, what were the prospects then?
Yeah, I mean, from my experience, when I was growing up, I never thought I'd work in whiskey. I thought I'd be a doctor, a medical doctor. That's what I studied first. And then I changed to chemistry. And then, of course, I just love creating new things. And again, had never thought of whiskey and just happened to see a job in the career service at Emory University that was for a research scientist, a Scotch Whisky Research Institute. So that was my apprenticeship, I suppose, for 4 years before I then got into distilling companies. But there's no wrong path. There are so many people get into it as ambassadors coming from bartending, for example, or into marketing or finance, or indeed in actually making the whisky through chemistry, chemical engineering, or through the Institute of Brewing and Distilling or Heriot Watt University, which runs a program in brewing distilling. So my middle son is doing that brewing and distilling degree at Heriot Watt University. So, you know, that sets you up in great stead. And there's new distilleries popping up, 133 distilleries in Scotland. The future is bright. So, yes, the distilleries will be employing fresh new talent in the future. And it's a great diverse industry to be part of. So I'd encourage people to join. I've had an amazing journey being part of whisky and worked with so many great distilleries, you know, from the Highlands, the North Highlands up in by the Cromarty Firth to the Islands, to Isla, to Glasgow, to Aberdeenshire, all over, as well as travelling the world. It's such a global product now that it just enriches your life being part of the industry, because you can meet so many people from different cultures who love single malt.
And perhaps just lastly, I'm just curious about where you see sort of the biggest growth opportunity in that market. You talk about the global interest, and we'll all know about expensive whiskey auctions and affluent collectors, let's say, of some of the great older whiskies that are out there, more prominent ones. But where sort of is the growth today? Is it in sort of the entry-level single malts? Talk to me a little bit about that and how you sort of plan the range, because this has to be often done without knowing what the market is going to be like for years ahead.
Absolutely. You know, I wish I had a crystal ball looking at the long-term forecasting for single malt, because single malt is the highest quality. It's the most complex material you can distill with malt, and we create, you know, some of the finest spirits in the world through our processes and through maturation. But yeah, it's a challenge to land the portfolio, and you know, we have to look at what we've got and what we're going to make for the future. So the inventory, that's the thousands of casks that are maturing in our warehouses, and then also what are we going to distill this year for the future? And what does that balance look like? The wood types, the level of peated whiskey or classic whiskey that we produce. So it's a bit of gut feel, and there's a bit of, obviously, insights from the markets, absolutely. And in creating a portfolio, I mean, where there is a sweet spot for real growth and what people gravitate towards are the 10 and 12-year-old age statements. And these are the ages where it's the perfect balance of flavour. It's affordable, it's exquisite taste, it's rich, and that is what is growing. There's also a growth in the craft, which are maybe some expressions where, you know, small batches that are from a distillery, not necessarily with an age statement, but something to explore particular facets of flavour. So, for example, from our floor maltings, we have spirit that's only been distilled in the malting season, and we have whiskey that's only distilled in the smoke season. And you know, these would be craft batches that we will release from time to time as well, and that's something that's also growing, that interest in craft. And then of course you've got the people at the top end, or certainly with gifting, you know, we're very fortunate to have 21, 25, and 30-year-old Benriach in beautiful, beautiful, luxurious boxes that are delicious whiskies, four cask matured, the most intense flavour experience imaginable. But they're still very reasonably priced. And then, of course, for the future, you know, we have whiskey right back to 1966. So in terms of the very top end, I would say watch this space. We'll see what that becomes.
Well, very exciting to think about the future there. Rachel, I know I've taken a good deal of your time. I do appreciate it. Thank you so much for this.
Yes, thank you, Daniel. It's my pleasure.
Rachel Berry, Master Blender for Benriach Distillery, speaking to me from Scotland. You can learn more at benriach.com, BENRIACH.com. Next up, we're off to New York to meet Sylvie Shantikai. Sylvie launched her eponymous beauty brand more than 20 years ago, a business she said is aimed at funding her other passion, conservation. From helping regrow populations of monarch butterflies to raising awareness about overfishing of tuna and helping to support a foundation for endangered elephants, Sylvie's life is all about the natural world. Originally from France, Sylvie grew up enamored by nature, which she was dearly missing when she moved to New York City in her early 20s. She launched a cosmetic line with her friend, the fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg, before she was approached by another pioneer of cosmetics, Estée Lauder. They launched a beauty company together called Prescriptives, where, as you'll hear, Sylvie started to experiment with natural ingredients and created a more natural look as well in makeup. In the late 90s, Sylvie set out on her own, creating her own label, which she still runs as a family business with her husband and children. Working with the best labels in Japan to make products from plants and flowers, and the top artisans to help make fragrance in France, it's a luxury cosmetics company driven by nature. Here's the story from Sylvie.
When I was living in France, I was in the country every weekend. I lived in Paris. In Paris, I lived near the parks, so I was in the green a lot. And in France, we had a house in the country within an hour of Paris, and my mother was a mad gardener, and we did everything. You know, she loved it, and there was a farm that we used, and we had everything. So it was very natural. There was a lot of that. And then I spent summer in the south of France on an island called Porquerolles, which was a private island at that time. So we were also living wild, really wild. I mean, there was nobody there. We were in the bikinis and barefoot for 3 months. It was idyllic. So nature has always been a big part of my life. And I've always loved animals, really loved animals. So when I came to New York, the first year I cried all the time. I thought New York was so ugly. I came from Paris, and Paris, you know, we had beautiful windows, we had balconies, everything was very, you know, refined and beautiful. And New York seemed to me so rough, and all these buildings would go up one day and go down the next day, and you walk a place and there was nothing left, they had destroyed. It was very strange, the windows were not attractive. It was just wild. But I made amazing friends, and I discovered incredible people, and I discovered myself, which is what New York is about. I always say, Nicole, New York is a litmus test. You are going to be who you're going to be, and if you come to New York, it's accelerated. But when I came to New York, I had a bunch of friends from France. I was very social in Paris, so I did things with friends in the beginning, you know. I mean, I did this company with Diane von Furstenberg. She was a friend, and her husband was a really close friend of mine, and we grew up together, and so we did this company. So that was how I got into cosmetics. I wasn't interested in 7th Avenue and fashion. And I thought, no, let's do something else. And she said, what do you want to do? I said, why don't we do a cosmetic company? So we did that. And I had to look for everything because I didn't know how to find anything. I'd been in New York for maybe 4 months at that time. I just had a baby. I was married for a year and a half. We came from France to New York. And, you know, I opened the Yellow Pages. And I found a lab, I found where you could buy things, and I just went around and figured it out and put a line together. And then Diane had the intelligence to hire the designer that were working on her apartment then, and we did this beautiful little store on Madison, which looked like a Guerlain boutique, and we launched Diane von Furstenberg Cosmetics. It had to bear her name because she was famous, I wasn't. And it was great fun. It was also amazing for me because I really put a whole company together and really thought on how to create something strong and create for perfumes and create product and really understood people. The beauty about having the store is that I saw all kinds of skins. And I love to watch people. Since I was a little girl, in the bus in Paris going to school, I would always watch people. And when I was in London, I would watch people. And I would always figure out what they look like and how better they could look if they did something else. And that's always been something that I do automatically. It's like a game. So having a store, you saw all these women come, so you realize what they needed, what they could do if it was, you know, looked at properly. And because I have a very keen eye for color, because I grew up with parents that were art collectors and were very artistic, and I had really studied arts all my life, and that's something that appealed to me. So that's how, you know, created colors that work for people. And at that time, we kept the company for 4 years. We sold it, you know, it was not very far from the Lauder office on Madison and 63rd, and the office on 57th. So somebody I knew them very, very well, and they asked to meet me. They said, you know, would you be interested in coming on board and create a company for us? Which was like, we're just giving you the candy store, you know? I mean, you walk in, and there are all these people that can do stuff for you. There's a lab, there's people who do packaging, there's people who design. So I was kind of fascinated to do this. So we created a company. I mean, I thought about it a lot and created a company that was very different and very new at the time, because it was more traditional. You know, you have to realize this was 77. We're talking about 78. And 1978, women wore a lot in America. They wore a lot of makeup. They wore a lot of pink on their face. They wore a lot of fake nails. They wore a lot of big hairs. And at the same time, the young generation, my generation, were very natural. And the girls had burned their bras, you know what I mean? That was the whole generation of freedom. And they didn't want to look like their mother at all. So when I start thinking about what I want to do, I want to do something that corresponds to this generation.
Through the cosmetics line that you started with Deanne, and then later Prescriptives, which you launched with Estee Lauder, was the idea there, as you say, to do something a little bit more natural and against the grain? Or were you thinking about how you could sort of bring in your own interests of sort of that natural look and also bringing in the natural world to your products?
What I was trying to do at that time was very technical. It wasn't about nature. And this is really important because it helped me go my own way later. Is that I thought, you know, nobody had done really a lot of science in cosmetics. And we were very lucky there was a really good person at Lauder that was interested in researching new ingredients and science. And we went very far. And I was fascinated by that. I have a very scientific curiosity in me. So I was always looking for new things. So we were doing, the skincare was very scientific. What I discovered as we were doing it and selling it is that people's skin are not necessarily reacting well to this. And you have to be more natural. You know, after years of Prescriptive, my desire was to do things that were really much more natural. And also it corresponds to me. I like to make my own jam. I like to have things that are natural. I like to smell the thing that smell amazing. I like to touch the fruits. I want to be close to nature. So the product for me have to be that way. So it evolved into literally, it was a curve. You know, I went to very accurate, then I went to extremely scientific, and then from there, I went back to nature. And so when I created my own company, I went full into nature.
Yeah, talk to me about that, because you started at the beginning by talking about your move to New York in your 20s and sort of that New York mentality of make or break, let's say. What did it take you to get to that point where you had the confidence to set out on your own?
It took me 20 years. It didn't happen overnight. It's interesting because when I first started at Lauder, I remember Ron Lauder said to me, you know you're going to have your own company, you know that. And I thought, yeah, sure. I threw myself into this, you know, all soul and body into creating this company. And you do think all the way, and you don't think necessarily about the next thing. You think, I'm going to do the best I can with this. It took me really understanding deeply myself and what I didn't like and what I didn't want. And then having this deep sense that I can do it. I was 50 when I started my company. And I always said women's life starts at 50 because it's the age when you're probably not going to have children anymore. It's the age when you don't have to think of others before you think of yourself. And you don't take any prisoners at that time. And so you do your thing. And I think that at that time, you have all your knowledge, you have all the things you know you don't like, and you have a deep understanding of who you are and a deep understanding of where you want to go. And to me, that was really like, I don't know if you surf, but it's getting on the board and going with the wave. And that's how I felt. And that's when I was able to do my own company. And I was able to really bring the things I love.
Yeah, and on that point, you said to me in the past that this company has allowed you, let's say, to fuel your real passion, and that's in conservation and the animals that you started by talking about and nature. So how do you blend those two worlds? Obviously, it's quite something after many years in the business to start out on your own and start from scratch. You will have had the confidence and the know-how to know what you wanted. But what's that like? And how do you sort of marry those two worlds that you're interested in?
Well, first of all, you have to realize going on your own, and if you don't take anybody's money, it's a hell of a gamble. And you're putting everything you have on the last. I mean, I took a second mortgage on my house, I cashed my retirement plan, and I did it. Okay, so this was already an enormous jump into trust in myself. And then you realize that maybe there is more to this. It's not just about creating a beautiful product. I have other passion in life. So I was lucky that I was able to see that there was a need. The first need was something that I'm seeing again in my garden this week, is all those butterflies traveling. They're traveling back from really the north of Canada all the way back down to Mexico for their winter. So the monarch butterflies, the large orange butterflies. I was told by other gardeners there used to be hundreds more. So I studied that and I thought, wow, they're being killed. And the global warming is also making it much worse for them, because when they get out of chrysalis, the flower that they feed on has already bloomed. So it was a very interesting thing. And I thought, maybe I can do something. And I found these scientists, wonderful two women, who had a place in the Mexican Michoacán region, where those extraordinary trees are, where you see this agglomeration of butterflies, one of the most amazing sights. And they were saying they're being destroyed. They're being destroyed by the locals. There's an act that the Mexican government did called the Peones Act that gave the land to these people to culture. So they're taking those trees down. So I made these three really beautiful eyeshadows. And they were very interesting because not only were they beautiful, but they were technically a new thing. So we launched that and people loved it. And they said, this is really interesting. So we wrote, this is for the butterflies. And you may not know, but the butterflies are disappearing, and we're going to give money from this eyeshadows to help the butterflies. And that was the first time that I realized there was something could be done. And we gave 5% of our sales, which is a lot. It's a lot more than when people give 2% of their profit. You know, this is a huge thing to give directly from yourselves. And at that time, we're not a very big company, but we raised $25,000 with that. So when I gave that check to these women, those two scientists, they literally fell off their chair. They were so excited. They'd never seen so much money. And we were able to buy land. We were able to save trees and butterflies. So I thought, this is fantastic. You know, I can use what I do every day and with a creation that I love to do, and it really can help. And then from there, I started going to Africa. And then I was head over heels in love with Africa. And I started realizing all of the problem with the animals and the need to help. And I started with elephants. I met an extraordinary woman called Dame Daphne Sheldrick, who had created, in honor of her husband who had died, the David Sheldrick Trust. And she was the first woman who knew how to take a baby elephant and to raise him, and finding the formula that can allow them to survive, because nobody knew how to do it, they would all die. And she was able to find it. And today, the trust has returned 250 elephants to the wild. And now Daphne died 2 years ago. Her daughter, Angela, has continued the Sheldrick Trust. It's an extraordinary organization. And it's very, very big now. It's one of the great, great success stories of conservation. So these opened my heart to what could be done.
Sylvie, thank you so much for your time. This has been absolutely fascinating.
Lovely to talk to you. Hi, Daniel.
Sylvie Shantikai, the founder of Shantikai, speaking to me from New York. You can learn more about the brand and their incredible work at shantikai.com.
That's all for this week's show. My thanks to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.